Hello and welcome to another current affairs edition of Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. Four topics to chew over in this programme. We'll be looking at the government's intention to regulate letting agents, including the creation of a legally enforceable code of practice and an independent regulator. How feasible are proposals from a parliamentary select committee that landlords' properties should be confiscated should they commit certain offences? Ellie Flynn's BBC Three documentary Sex for Rent exposed a dark underworld of free rooms in exchange for sexual favours. We will be discussing what should be done about this and whether men advertising these rooms are really landlords or just criminals. But first, we're going to be looking at data protection changes which will affect the private rented sector from the 25th of May 2018, known as GDPR. I'm joined in the studio by Marlon Fox, Managing Director of Outlook Property, and of course, Chris Norris, Director of Policy and Practice at the National Landlords Association. So, Chris, these GDPR regulations, General Data Protection Regulation, as it's called, that's its full title. How aware and indeed compliant do you think landlords and agents are of their current obligations under the Data Protection Act?
Oh, under the Data Protection Act? I'm not sure they're very aware at all. I think fortunately, and this doesn't come across a lot in the speculation and all of the scaremongering, it's not very difficult to comply. As long as you're applying common sense and you're applying a reasonable amount of security, and I don't mean fancy encryption programs or, you know, padlocks everywhere, but as long as you're maintaining a relative level of security about the files you hold, you're okay. I think when it comes to GDPR, there's a few things that landlords and letting agents particularly need to understand, and it's getting through slowly, but there's a lot more fear than there is understanding at the moment.
Yeah, now I've looked into this, and there must be a legal basis for processing personal data once the new regulations come in. And it seems to me the three that would apply to landlords are contracts. So if you need to process data in order to comply with the contract, of course, mm-hmm. we all have tenancy agreements. Legal obligation, and that I presume would be to comply with things like right to rent regulations.
Yeah.
And then also legitimate interests. So legitimate interest pursued by the data controller, and there needs to be a balance there between the needs of the data controller and the interest of the individual. And I suppose that might be the tenant requests a repair, I then have to pass on their details to my contractor, that sort of thing.
Yeah, most of the duties that a landlord has, or most of the activity that a landlord will carry out, will either be captured by contract, because there are certain things you've got to do to uphold your part of that legal contract, that tenancy, or because you've got a legitimate business interest to do so. And as long as you've made clear that you're relying on those, there isn't a lot else you've got to do. I think the important thing for a landlord to remember with legitimate interest is there is that balancing test that you mentioned. And you have got to do just a little bit of a desktop exercise, really, just to note down what it is you need to capture, why you need it, and what the flip side of that would be. So what the protections that your tenant might expect. But that really is basic stuff. It's not an academic exercise that means you've got to go through, you know, reams of legalese. You've just got to note down what you're using it for.
And the NLA has produced a guide for landlords, which I think is very useful, actually, and also model policy notice that landlords can modify and send
out.
We've got
three basic tools at the moment for landlords, and there's more coming. So we've got a section on our online library. So if you are doing CPD, you're doing some training, there's a section you can read through. It's not too long, but maybe half an hour of work for a landlord to understand what data protection really is. It's not just GDPR. We've got a guide you can download and take away and, you know, read wherever you find comfortable to do your reading, to understand what you've got to do. And then there's a fair processing notice. So sometimes called a privacy notice. It's really simple. It's a few pages. It's a little bit daunting because solicitors drew it up for us. But there's some sections you put in your details, you put in your tenant's details, and it explains why a landlord needs some personal information.
Now, Marlon, as an agent, you must be holding a lot more data than your average landlord. What have you been doing to prepare for GDPR?
Well, I agree with Chris that it's a common sense issue. I mean, there's no question of that. And I don't think it's quite as scary as everyone's making out. I mean, it's, you know, do I think agents have been on the ball in terms of the current legislation? Probably not. But I mean, the reality is that this is probably needed. And we've gone through a process of attending seminars, and we've had a GDPR consultant come in and have a look at our operation. And it is common sense. I mean, you have to show a due process of how you're handling data. And the interesting thing is some of the seminars I've been to, taken by lawyers actually, GDPR sort of data protection lawyers, one of the things they've made very clear to me is that legislation coming in is meant to be slightly ambiguous. They're sucking as they see, basically. So, you know, they've left it reasonably vague so that they can interpret the regs as they go along, rather than being particularly rigid.
And what should landlords expect from agents? Will there be any difference in the service that they get?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, the software provider, who remain nameless, who we use at the moment, they were very slow to the table, really, in terms of providing the necessary tools we needed to ensure that we complied. And actually, but what they've provided is actually pretty good. So it's going to allow us for tenants and landlords to be able to determine their own sort of specific requirements of what they want from us and how we can utilise their data. And they can do that remotely, which is quite an interesting thing. The funny thing is that I actually feel the sort of data that we hold, with the exception of referencing, is actually pretty vague. It doesn't really fall into the sensitive data section of this new regulation. Most of the stuff is pretty generic stuff. Funny enough, as a business owner, I'm more interested in how GDPR affects our employment records, where there is, you know, issues of, you know, details of children and medical, issues that members of staff may have. That's probably a bigger challenge for us than actually the landlord and tenant side.
Chris, I get asked a lot by landlords if they need to comply with GDPR if they use an agent, because they claim that they don't process as much data. What would be the answer to that?
Oh, well, they don't process as much data, but they're still the data controller. So unless... But the one caveat I always put into this, because we have lots of members calling up asking about this, there are certain business models, certain schemes where you completely sublet through another company. Now, if you're in one of those arrangements and you don't hold any personal information about that person, okay, there are very few requirements, but you're still running a business. You've still got to be aware of all of this. The bit that really confuses a lot of landlords is where they use an agent for full management of all of their properties, and therefore they take care of all the paperwork. And I think that's the confusion. There's a confusion between paperwork, because that lives in the letting agent's office, and data. And as long as you are the landlord and you're named as the landlord on that tenancy agreement and it's your property, you remain the data controller. So you've got to make sure that your agent is handling that data in a professional and compliant way. And it doesn't take much. You just need to understand what the privacy policy is for that agency and to have asked the right questions.
And there are quite hefty sanctions, aren't there, actually, as well? Up to 4% of turnover if you don't comply with GDPR.
Absolutely. It's 4% of global turnover, or a very high arbitrary figure of something like 20 million euros.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, 20 million, that's right. Mm. Yeah, which is probably the headline figure that's frightening the pants of everyone.
It is. I think the bit for private landlords to be more concerned about is actually compensation. One of the things that's, it's not necessarily changing because this was available before, but it's becoming clearer, is that if you've got a tenant, let's say, who alleges a data breach, and they can allege that there's been some kind of damage, some kind of financial damage, or, you know, even psychological damage, if you can prove it, they can sue the landlord for that if they're responsible for the breach. So I don't think many landlords are going to worry or have to worry about 20 billion euro fines. But they might have to worry about a smaller proportionate fine, but potentially quite a large damages claim that takes quite a long time and quite a lot of effort and money to defend against.
Yes, and of course, tenants have the right to expect their data to be used properly, don't they, and securely. So make sure you have passwords and, you know, proper policies for dealing with their data. Moving on, the Housing, Communities and Local Government Select Committee made some recommendations recently. It said that the vast majority of private rented tenants are happy, but something like 800,000 of PRS homes have what it calls Category 1 hazards, which could be excess cold, mould or faulty wiring. This is an old chestnut, isn't it? You know, this kind of bottom end of the property having very poor conditions. Probably not something you come across so much, is it, Marlon, I would hope, in your business?
It's funny, isn't it? Because sometimes I hear about the PRS and it's a marketplace I don't even recognise in relation to the comments you've just made. You know, it's. I think at the end of the day, we act for landlords who provide adequate or outstanding accommodation. I mean, we just won't act for a client where the accommodation is substandard.
Chris, what do you think about this new proposal? I think this was from Clive Betts, the chairman, actually. He said, local authorities need the power to levy more sustainable fines against landlords and, in the case of the most serious offenders, ultimately be able to confiscate their properties.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting report. And, you know, Clive Betts has been around for a very long time. He's had a lot of evidence from a lot of us in front of that committee. You know, splitting that down, local authorities need to do more enforcement. I don't think anyone would really dispute that. The question for me is whether they need more powers to do that, because there's an awful lot of regulation out there that allows them to do a lot of different things, but they either don't have the money or they need to think differently about how they budget to do this kind of work. So something that we really welcomed that came into force only last month was the ability for local authorities to use civil penalty notices instead of going through the whole court process that takes a long time and a lot of effort. And it allows the authority to keep hold of more of the money, effectively, and plough that back into enforcement, which, you know, from our point of view, really great if you're targeting that at criminals. But they've got to start budgeting for doing the work. It's a bit chicken and egg. You know, until they start seeing the money, they can't fund the enforcement work. But they don't want to assume there's going to be enforcement, because that assumes guilt before you start doing the work. So they've got themselves caught up in this cycle. I mean, do they need any more powers in this particular element? No. You've got the Proceeds of Crime Act. You can already effectively bankrupt and seize everything that a criminal, and in these cases we're talking about criminals, not good landlords, owns. But it is very, very difficult to get that prosecution, to track that person down, and to do it in a timescale that means they haven't shifted all of their wealth off to the Middle East somewhere.
And we know how reluctant local authorities are to compulsorily purchase properties, or empty dwelling management orders as well are quite rare, I think, aren't they?
They're very, very rare. I mean, what I'd love to see actually is a bit more partnership working. I mean, if you think of one of the councils that has tried to use interim management orders recently is Waltham Forest, not a million miles away from Mull.
They have offices there, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, they've really struggled because it's a very expensive thing to do. But at no point have I seen local authorities, London boroughs like that, actually reach out to letting agents or established landlords in the area who could really play a role in bringing some of these properties back into use if it's an Edmo, or, you know, even if it's mentoring people who aren't necessarily criminal landlords but have been neglectful. Just to bring that back in, I think there's benefits on all sides.
We get the sense sometimes, I think, or I certainly get the sense that government is kind of piling on regulation and not really thinking about alternatives like partnership working or just trying to encourage better relationships between landlords and tenants. What do you think, Marlon?
Well, it's interesting that obviously you and I sat and met for some time on the Newham Landlord Forum, which was interesting. And that was during the time that, in the early days, when Newham were trying to launch their pioneering licensing scheme. And, I mean, you know, you'll be aware that the take on it then was that, you know, this was meant to be an educational process. So in the event that a landlord who wasn't a criminal but just didn't know what they were doing, you know, a bit naive perhaps, was, you know, left wanting, that they would be able to work in partnership with local managing agents. Well, I mean, Newham, I think, is the largest PRS sector in London, I think, in terms of, I think it's about 42,000 properties that they're let. And, we're the largest managing agent in Newham, and I've never, ever been approached in any way, shape or form to take on new landlords to try and help them in their, you know, with their businesses and educate them, which is a shame, because I think that's probably the way forward. I wonder whether or not, you know, Newham could claim they've been successful in launching this licensing scheme, whether it's actually had a positive effect on driving up standards. I'm not sure they could substantiate that claim. I don't know.
Actually, it's interesting that you asked that, because Robin Wales was in front of this committee.
Yeah,
he was one of the invited witnesses, because that is, you know, the leading, the pioneering, as you said, licensing scheme.
Yeah.
And, you know, whilst I don't want to put words in his mouth, he did have to concede that actually there was no hard evidence that it had improved the private rented sector.
No.
They do a lot more enforcement than practically anybody else in the country.
That's
and we'll
right.
give them credit for that.
Yeah.
But there's no hard evidence it's worked, and they've just renewed it for another 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's another story.
Yes. Well, if you have any thoughts on this or any other topics we're discussing today, do let us know via the website insideproperty.org.uk. You're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guests today are Chris Norris, Director of Policy and Practice at the National Landlords Association, and Marlon Fox, Managing Director of Outlook Property. Well, moving on actually to the regulation of agents, the government has announced that it wants to introduce a legally enforceable code of practice and regulatory body for agents. Now, we've seen lots of big changes for agents in the last couple of years, the tenants' fees ban, caps on deposits, a redress scheme, we've had transparency regulations. How are agents feeling about all of these regulations, Marlon?
We're not feeling very loved. I've been an agent now for 34 years, although I don't look that old, and I don't think I can ever remember a period where agents have been under agents and lettings, and my industry has been under such attack. I've always been a massive advocate and supporter of agents being fully licensed. Okay, because as far as I'm concerned, it's a very unlevel playing field. I'll give you an example. So my head office is in Stratford in East London, and on the road I'm based, which I'm number two, in that particular road there are 26 agents, and I'm one of three ARLA members, ARLA being the Associated Residential Letting Agents. And I mean, that what that means is that in order to compete with the agents that don't have to comply with all legislation and ARLA's guidelines, my costs are significantly higher. It also means that the landlords who go to the non-ARLA members are not getting the service that I can provide. So I've been a long-term fan of ensuring that before you can open a letting a managing agent, you are properly versed, trained, like a lawyer, like an accountant, like a surveyor. It seems inconceivable to me that anyone can go and open a property agency next door to me and compete and not be able to provide outstanding service and good advice to their clients. I just find that mind-boggling.
How do you see things, Chris? I mean, does the introduction of client money protection, this code and the regulator amount to the full regulation of agents, which Sajid Javid promised at the Tory Party conference in October?
I think we're getting there. I mean, I agree with a lot of what Marlon just said. I think the key part for us, you know, as you'd expect representing landlords, is we want to see outstanding service.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of agents out there that don't provide that level of service. So if this means that we can drag people up by the bootstraps to do better and get rid of some of those that are operating below the radar, then fantastic. I mean, what I'm really hoping this does is provide that comprehensive package. You know, we've been working with what's now the ministry for quite a few years on this, but it's been introduced in dribs and drabs. As you said, the transparency elements, some of the trading standards work, some of the EPC work, the even going all the way back to HIPS and, you know, previous governments, various little bits here and there. We've been saying for a long time, just stop for a minute, look at what the industry's doing, because ARLA's out there, NALS is out there, UCALA are out there, they've all got fairly similar models. I think ARLA's is probably the most stringent of the lot, and some people love it for that and some people hate it for that. But look at what they're doing. Find, you know, something that represents that service and then just apply it across the top. And hopefully, in maybe 18 months' time, that's what we'll see.
How hard is this ban on tenant fees going to hit agents? Are we going to see a thinning out, do you think, Marlon?
Yeah, unquestionably. I think, I mean, especially sort of the part of London I'm based in, which is sort of lower rents than the rest of London, I suppose it's inevitable that the loss on tenant fees is going to have a negative effect on the industry. I'm not convinced by any stretch that it's actually going to achieve what the government wants it to achieve. I think that tenants will pay additional charges through other mediums. I can see a lot of landlords wanting to increase rents. I mean, they're not going to be happy in an environment where they're already getting heavily taxed and loads of other legislation coming in. I don't think many landlords are going to be particularly happy for their agents to turn around and say, sorry, would you mind if we charge you another 3% on your fees? It's tight, margins are tight already. So
I struggle with this idea, Chris, that landlords might try and increase rents because, you know, rents are subject to market factors, yeah. aren't they? The ONS says that rents in Greater London, for example, have gone up by 0.1% over the 12 months to March. Yeah. So, you know, is that realistic to say that landlords might increase rents?
I think people ignore the necessary elasticity. So you've got to take into account what it's like any business, what your customer can afford to pay. But ultimately, you've got your costs. So landlords will try to make sure that rents cover their costs, and you've got the big taxation changes that are halfway through the implementation. Yeah. We've been forecasting since that announcement that rents will increase by about 7% above inflation, but that's recognising that landlords will have to absorb about 35% of the cost of that tax change. You pile on the tenant fee ban on top of that, and you know we're already saying there's no more elasticity. So I think we will see rents increase because of the aggregate of all of these policies. But it's only going to cover maybe half of landlords' costs. We're either going to have to cut those margins to the bone or see people leave the market.
And anything to fear from this new regulator? We already, of course, have these various ombudsmen and, you know, there's a concern that there are going to be too many of them.
Well, I think we've got to see what it looks like. On the ombudsman front, one doorway leading to, you know, a competitive marketplace of redress, it's a good thing. I think that can help the consumer. And you need to have someone that ultimately has authority over it. But, you know, we don't really want to see something of the size and the auspices of the FSA appearing at the top of it, or the FCA now, sorry. But just something that monitors compliance is probably necessary.
How do you feel about the idea of this new independent regulator, Marlon?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I was going to say earlier that I've always been a little bit sort of baffled why, not just in lettings but in sales as well, that the consumer doesn't really appear to, in my period of being an agent, being provided with adequate protection, and especially for I know we're talking landlords here, but for buyers and sellers, you know, the largest commercial transaction they'll ever get involved with in their entire lives, unless they're business people, it strikes me that they're just not afforded much protection. I find that bizarre, which is why I've always been an advocate of wanting licensing for agents. But in terms of the regulators, the one that made me laugh recently was the London Rental Standard brought in by Boris. And when they wrote to me and said it'd been cancelled, I wrote to them saying, "Can I have my money back, please?"
Right. Yes. know. I think the target on that was ludicrous as well, wasn't it? Because he wanted 100,000 people to become members or landlords to become members, and there were only 13,000 or 14,000 that were members at the time.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yes. Moving on to this sex for rent topic now. Now, Ellie Flynn produced and presented a programme called Ellie Undercover Sex for Rent, which was aired on BBC Three recently and is still available online. She looked into that sort of murky world of ads that were inviting, it's mostly from men inviting women to come and live with them rent-free in return for sexual favours. How did you respond to the documentary, Chris?
How did I respond to the documentary? My immediate response to the documentary was I can see why BBC Three is now online. But I think the issue, we've got to be very careful. You shouldn't conflate the issue of sex for rent, of what's going on here, with the problems we see in the private rented sector. This is completely separate from housing. This is inciting prostitution.
Yeah.
Yes, and Ellie was actually very clear that it is a criminal offence to incite prostitution and you can be in prison for 7 years. And she was puzzled why the police weren't doing anything about it as well, wasn't she?
I think for the police to take action in any crime, they need someone to report it.
Yeah.
And I think if you were to look into these cases, the reason they're not taking any more action is they don't know about it. Mm. And if you look at the traditional enforcement they would do against prostitution, there will be certain areas that they patrol, there will be high street shops, places that they raid. What can you do in somebody's home? You know, these people are put under an enormous amount of pressure, these people are very vulnerable, and I'm by no means trying to say they make a free choice there, but if people are making a pressurised choice to live in these homes, they're unlikely to go and make an accusation or an allegation or report it to the police. So there's no real reason that they find out about it.
Marlon, yeah. I was irked by the use of the term landlord and tenant because it seemed to me these were just corrupt individuals, which was the phrase used by one of the MPs. Yeah. And I did very much feel for the vulnerable women, really, that were putting themselves in that situation.
Yeah.
We've seen scams like this on Gumtree, and Craigslist was the main offender in this case. And do you see a lot of this sort of stuff going on in East London?
I don't. Again, another marketplace I guess I'm just not exposed to. But to agree with Chris with what he just said, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, quite shocking to watch Ellie present her documentary. It doesn't feel like it's anything to do with the housing market. I mean, it's I hope not an attempt to demonise landlords. I mean, without sounding in any way patronising, obviously the terrible shame that these women are in this position where they feel forced to go down the route they go down in terms of trying to get a roof over their heads. I mean, it's a sad indictment of life, perhaps, at the moment, that they have to go that route. But I'm not sure where the housing market and rentals really comes into it, because at the end of the day, it's basically money or something of value being utilised in exchange for sex. I mean, it's...
Just following on from the whole kind of Me Too debate that's going on at the moment, how much inappropriate behaviour do you think goes on between agents and landlords and tenants, Marlon? Have you come across many cases? You know, people would argue that tenants are often in quite vulnerable situations and landlords could just kind of turn up and use their own key to get into the property when they're not invited, etc.
Well, I'm not aware of any cases, and if I was, I'd come to like a ton of bricks on those involved. I'm not aware of any cases. I mean, in terms of accessing properties and tenants' vulnerability, well, there are strict guidelines as to under the tenancy agreement and in statute as to how we, as managing agent or one of our contractors or landlords, actually access a property. So we have to give due notice we're going to go in if something needs to be done within the property. I'm not aware of any issues that would cause me concerns.
I'm just wondering about advice to tenants as well who find themselves in such a desperate situation, Chris, that they can't afford rents in their local area. We saw one woman being assisted by a charity. I mean, what advice would we give to tenants in that situation?
I think it's incredibly difficult, and we know, particularly with some of the welfare reform changes that have taken place over recent years, more people are finding themselves in real difficulty. But the first port of call has got to be to present to the local authority. There are duties there, and thankfully, because of the work of a lot of us in the industry, and particularly crisis, the Homelessness Reduction Act comes into force this year, which puts a lot more duties onto a local authority to prevent. So it's not just cases of people who are actively homeless now. There's a lot more they've got to do now for sofa surfers, for instance. So present, make sure you articulate your circumstances the best that you can. I think in some of these cases, sometimes when people have been, you know, been turned away. I think one of the case studies in the documentary, the lady who was helped by a charity, had presented to the local authority. Something had been lost in communication there, because it seemed quite clear that she had vulnerabilities. You know, try to get there, try to get the support from local charities if you can. You know, contact organisations like Porchlight or like Crisis, who can put you in touch with local organisations. And there is help there, even if it's temporary accommodation. Nobody should have to go, you know, go to these types of individuals.
And thankfully, the housing element of universal credit for 18 to 21 year olds has been restored as well, and that will certainly go a long way, I think, to helping any vulnerable women who find themselves in that situation. Well, that's it for this programme. My thanks to my guests Marlon Fox and Chris Norris, and to you for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the programme. Maybe you'd like to leave a review on Audio Boom or iTunes, and would you be interested in joining a listener's panel? If so, please do get in touch via the website, which is insideproperty.org.uk. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.